qua non ci deve essere più niente. Bisogna cominciare subito. Coraggio, al lavoro, buttate giù. Dico bene, autore?
Sì, grazie. Arrivederci, ragazzi. Ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.
Welcome to Cinema Italia, a podcast dedicated to the world of Italian cinema. Presented by me, John Bleasdale. Everybody, and welcome to Cinema Italia, the podcast which celebrates all that's great about Italian cinema and criticizes all that's terrible. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Lillian Crawford, whose writing has appeared lots of different places. You did a wonderful article on Zone of Interest, which absolutely, yeah, it was one of the, I've just kind of not been reading much about the Zone of Interest because it's moved me so much as a film that I don't want to enter into the discourse, so to speak. But your piece totally superseded that or overcame that sort of reluctance.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I was really grateful to write that. I'd sort of been itching to write about Zone of Interest since I'd seen it, and was struggling to get anyone to commission me to write about it. So I was very pleased to be able to explore that film.
And sorry, just to get straight, so you're writing for Rabbitsford?
I write for Sight and Sound, Little White Lies, The Guardian, Times Literary Supplement.
Round up the usual suspects.
Yeah, exactly. It's the usual people. Anyone who will let me write, pretty much.
Fair enough. And today we're going to be looking at a film that I think this is only the second time I've watched it, Death in Venice, Luchino Visconti's adaptation of Thomas Mann's novella. When did you first come across?
I was trying to think about this when I suggested it, when I would have first have seen any of it. I think, as with most films, it was. I must have seen a clip from it, I think, as a teenager. And I think I remember hearing the Mahler, and it was around the time when I was really obsessed with Mahler and his music. But I didn't see the film. I didn't see the film for quite a few years. And quite a few years later, and I'd read the book many years ago. Love Thomas Mann, obsessed with The Magic Mountain when I was starting at university. But I don't think I actually saw it until a year or two ago in its entirety. And it quickly became one of my absolute favorite films. I think I've always been slightly concerned about watching film adaptations of books that I love, especially a book like this, which is so grounded in the aesthetic and sensibility and beauty and the subconscious thoughts of Aschenbach, that I did not know how that could be translated into film. But the film for me completely captures what Mann is expressing in the novella, but in a very different way, in a much more visceral way, I suppose, than literature is really capable of.
It's a film, I on rewatch, I was thinking, this is like a COVID film. I was so right. Aware watching this film of how close people were to each other and how being sick puts you in a different world to other people. And it's like Venice is a place, but it's also a state of mind. It's also a state of physical being, you know? This film has this central performance by Dirk Bogarde. And at this stage, this is kind of very much the latter part of his career. I mean, he's sort of an established actor. He's done a lot of his big roles already. But this is one of the crowning glories of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what's so moving about this film to me is the casting of Bogarde. And obviously the character is, well, he's from sort of hazy origins. He's a Silesian gentleman with a sort of aristocratic surname, but he comes to Venice and he is an outsider to that. But I think it's very important that Aschenbach isn't played by an Italian actor within the film. So Bogarde is sort of this outside figure, but it's so moving to me when you watch Bogart's earlier films, any film that he made prior to the legalization of homosexuality in Britain in 67. All of those films, films like Victim, films like The Servant, where you really get, retrospectively perhaps, a real sense of Bogart's homosexuality and his queerness framed in a certain way and how that translates into his performance and the way that and the directors he worked with in Britain, who were also hiding their own homosexuality or the homosexuality of people on their crews. So I think it's really extraordinary to watch this film, which is all about repression of sexuality. It's all about sort of repressing an aspect of oneself that might get in the way of the pursuit of art or beauty or intellectual endeavor, I suppose. It's about hiding that away in order to achieve something intellectually or artistically, and how that just sort of ruptures out of him almost in this film. And I think that that's certainly what you see in Bogart's life, in Bogart's career, which is really tragic. It moves me to tears. I mean, I weep throughout this film, but the final moments, which I surely will come to, but that's everything that Bogart in his own life is suppressing and hiding in order to have a career in acting, particularly in British cinema, but then also working in Italian cinema. He also works with Liliana Cavani on The Night Porter, I think, shortly after Death in Venice. So I don't know. I suppose there's a certain element that one perceives that he finds perhaps greater understanding with Visconti and the crew on this film, which I'm sure we will also talk about. We don't really know what they were doing when they were making this film. There's certainly some rumours around how they were treating Bjørn Anderson and his relationship to them. But I am the way that the positivity, I suppose, in that respect, is that there is this sort of community that Bogart can exist in, making this film of gay men at a time when that wasn't something that he had perhaps experienced that much prior to this point.
Yeah, I mean, even at the very beginning of his career, he's sort of like the sex symbol for, you know, the various, is it the Doctor films that he does in Britain?
Yeah, yeah. And hugely popular with women audiences. I mean, he was sold as a sort of sex symbol in that respect. So it's a real, you know, that's why Victim is so radical. And that's what, 10 years before Death in Venice. So it's to reframe him that way and to cast this actor as a gay man, it completely changes how people, and that's why that film was banned and was so controversial. Well, it was banned for many reasons, including the fact that it uses the first film to use the word homosexual. It completely changed his relationship and that sort of blurring of the lines between an actor in a film and the characters that they portray. And I suppose comes down again and makes farce of that argument that we should know the sexuality of every actor playing every character, because there is such an important right to privacy and the way that it changes sort of how actors are sold to an audience.
When we get to the, you know, at the very beginning of the film, we have him arriving in Venice, and so we arrive in Venice at the same time, and we're sort of automatically kind of aligned with him. I mean, he's it's interesting that he's kind of quite a grumpy character right from the get-go. There's no sort of attempt to, from one point of view, you sort of see him sort of looking at things and you're looking at them with him and you align with him. And then he's going, I don't want you to take me there, take me here. And you're just thinking, what the heck's wrong with him? He's kind of a prickly presence, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a very sort of, the climate doesn't agree with him. Nothing seems to agree with him. He's quite a disagreeable character, and we're just immediately thrust into that sensibility that he has. What I think is quite remarkable about the soundtrack is that opening when he comes in on the steamer is that we're already getting the Mahler Adagietto, and that to start with that kind of sensibility is really striking, because normally you'd save that for the final time that it appears, but it's throughout the film. It's constantly in his head. And I think that gives us a real sense of of who this man is and what his general, because I suppose that's what Mann is doing at the start of the novella. I mean, the description of Aschenbach is directly taken from a photograph of Mahler that Mann had. The book is inspired by Mahler's death in 1911, which is the same year that Mann went to Venice and had a very similar experience, falling in love with this young boy. So I suppose that's why we're introduced to him. We know that this is a man who is going to die quite quickly, I would say.
It's on the tin.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that this is a film in which there is any element of optimism that this man is going to get what he wants in any sense. He just, because he can't. And that's the, it's impossible to describe that as a tragedy, because obviously he cannot have what he wants, because it is, and he knows that. And I think that's really what is, this is not a healthy desire, is what I'm trying to say. I don't think it is ever treated as such, which the film has been criticized for, is that it's, and as of course was the novella, and that this is sort of fetishizing paedophilia, I suppose, is kind of, but in the same way that Nabokov is criticized for doing that in Lolita. And really what fascinates me and compels me is that, even right from the beginning, that this is such a character study of a man whose mind is so turbulent and really quite pathetic. I mean, it just, the pathos is overwhelming, as indeed it is in Mahler's music. And it's not, I suppose, to everyone's taste. People can find that kind of sensibility overpowering and too much. Whereas for me, I do find that emotionally overwhelming.
Yeah, in a positive sense. And I wonder as well if that emotional response that you're having to the music and the way the Mahler comes in, I mean, huge, I love Mahler. I had this, you know, remember, I'm not sure if you remember, but like Naxos CDs going back some time, used to have like a compilation of just the adagios. And that sort of was my entry drug into then listening to all of the 10 symphonies and then going on to the Lieder and what have you. And it's just amazing stuff. But it's almost like that's partly what you're seeing, is this dichotomy between his pettiness and his profundity. There's this sort of, on the one hand, there's this genius, and then there's this guy who's fussy about his hotel room and wants to, you know, wants to make sure, you know, not quite sure where he wants to sit at dinner and that sort of thing. And then, so that's kind of already there before he even sees the boy. Tadjo, is it? I think the character.
Tadjo, yeah.
Tadjo, yes.
Well, you can sort of say, well, it's quite funny because at first it sort of sounds like adagio. It's A-D-G-I-O, Tadjo. He mishears it and decides that his name must be Tadjo. He doesn't actually... Is it even mentioned in the film? I'm not sure it is mentioned. I think we overhear his family saying that the name, which is a shortened form of Thaddeus, which so I don't know. is the simple answer.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking of him. He sort of turns up almost like a character from a comedy in a way, that he's the punctilious aesthete who wants everything to be exactly so, and he quite pompous. I'm never sure. It's a long time since I've read the novella, but is it explicit why he's in Venice and why he's alone?
No. It's the shorter. I think it's just he's an aesthete who goes to Venice in the way that sort of gentlemen do, in the sort of grand tour kind of way. Is how I might be wrong. I might have forgotten that detail from the book. But it's he's in the novella, he's a writer, so he's written this book called The Abject, which I suppose is a direct sort of Freudian discussion of that kind of suppression that I was talking about, whereas in the film he's a composer, and that's the big distinction is that Visconti really brings out the Mahler comparison. We have these flashbacks to the wife that we're told about who died, and their child who died, just like Mahler and Alma Mahler's daughter died when she was four, and how that affected Mahler and brought out his music for the rest of his life. So that's shown in the film. And we also have these these additional conversations that Aschenbach has with a friend who's either a musician or a composer. It's not really clear. And they talk about sort of the spiritual in music and the relationship, the aim of beauty, the point of beauty, and the distinction between beauty being something that one has to work for and something that simply exists or simply happens. And it really is sort of reminiscent of a lot of Mahler's own writing, the idea of sort of embrace the music must, like, the world embrace everything is very much a belief of his. And then also, there's a sense that Aschenbach has perhaps not been the most successful writer, we also get that with Aschenbach as composer. There's a premiere of a piece which results in sort of riotous display, which leads to the comparison of Aschenbach to Sergei Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe. Diaghilev loved this book and used to take young lovers to the Hotel de Bain and died there. He was very much sort of committed to the idea. And
that's Diaghilev, very of course, committed. You like yeah. Death in Venice, and so you die in Venice. That's like, I would
at
say,
the hotel.
I would say you've stand enough. You stand yourself to death.
I would agree. But of course, Diaghilev oversaw the premiere of Rite of Spring prior to the First World War. So there's all of these connections in the film that Visconti is bringing out, and again a very sort of a group of repressed homosexuality, but then also the excess of that. There's an incredible moment in the novella when Aschenbach has a dream which is very Dionysian. He really realizes that he is sexually attracted to the boy, which again is not in the film. There is a removal of the very classical, neoclassical tone of the book, and the use, all of the so many references to gods and to Olympus and the behavior of the gods, who of course Zeus and Ganymede had a similar sort of predilection for young boys in a very similar way. So it's interesting to me that is sort of removed from the film. This is very much a film grounded in that reality, and that's why I think that compositional element is brought into it. And we have, because you have to replace that very internal aspect of Aschenbach's mind that is in the book, and how do you portray that without having a constant sort of stream of consciousness narrator? We have those flashbacks and we have those conversations that are still ringing in his head these years later, when he is a less successful composer than he had set out to be.
I think that choice of the music is a huge radical choice, and a really important one, because it allows the film to be cinematic properly. And I think if you have him sort of John Boy Waltoning the narration or something like that, and sitting at his desk, you know, far be it from me to recall the years of former glories, but I find as I sit here, it's just like it turns films into radio plays. And sure. But you have that music, and you have that imagery, and you know, I mean, it's kind of like why I feel he's so cross with people is everybody's interrupting that music in his head, you know. Right. And everybody's interrupting that way he has of seeing stuff. Mm-hmm. That when you communicate it, it's just going to sound sordid or wrong, which I'm not using to justify. But going back to what you were saying earlier, human desire does not run within the trammels of you know, whatever the current law is for everybody. And either, what do? You want to eliminate that human reality entirely, or do you want to think about it and discuss it? And thinking about it and discussing it does not require for us to approve of it. So that's my defense. Not that giants like Nabokov, Thomas Mann and Visconti require any help from me, but that would be my defense as a viewer for watching it and being interested in it.
To me, it's self-evident. I just think that these characters are compelling. And in the same way that, you know, American Beauty is an excellent example of a film that is such a fascinating character study of this kind of sort of, for want of a better word, nonce character. And
there's no better word. There's no better word than nonce character.
They're perverted men, and it's a character study of them. But then American Beauty is a film that has undergone such a critical revision. I still think that it explores these themes in a very similar way. I don't really understand why that's not something that is of interest. I don't think that one seems to be an obsession with the idea that one's protagonist must be, you know, likable, I suppose, in some way. But I think what's really interesting and is the connection of that to Tar, which of course portrays that in the character study of a woman, which has been treated in a very different way, and how and the sort of relationship of audiences to Lydia Tár as a character, that Tár is talking right from the beginning about her relationship to Mahler's Fifth and Mahler's Fifth as coming out of that sort of love that Gustav Mahler had for Alma Mahler, and the as I said, about the difficulty of their sort of grief over the loss of their child, and how that symphony sort of, she's obsessed with it in that film. And there's a great line when she's rehearsing the Adagietto, and she says, no, forget Visconti. This is, you know it too well. You have to forget how it's how Visconti uses it, and that kind of emotionality in Death in Venice. And it's such a throwaway line, but it's very much at the heart of that. It's, what she's trying to do is something different with that symphony. I think over the past year, there have been three films which have used the Adagietto in this way. The other one being Maestro and Bernstein's relationship with Mahler. And then a film which I saw only a couple of weeks ago, which at BFI Flair, called Les Jours Heureux, or Days of Happiness, which very similarly ends with a young female conductor conducting the Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth and having these flashbacks to her childhood and finally learning how to let go as a conductor and embrace music. And it all comes back to this use in Death in Venice. And all of those films have used that movement as a way of exploring, similarly to how Aschenbach feels as a lover of music and as a musician, as a composer, that they are simply not as good as the people who have come before them, or a sense of inadequacy before Mahler, I suppose, is a way of putting it. Bernstein is a far superior interpreter of Mahler than he is an individual composer. That's what Maestro is about as a film. At least that's how I read that film. So I think it's really interesting how the legacy of that use of that symphony in this film, because there are, well, obviously, I suppose another example that would come to mind is something like Brief Encounter and its use of Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. That use of a single piece of music is so important, and where that also breaks within the film, when we first see Tasha, I believe it's the Merry Widow Waltz by Leha that's playing, which is a much lighter sort of, you know, Viennese operetta that is playing at that moment. And then what does Taschio play on the piano when he sees him? It's Verolisa by Beethoven, which is played in this sort of slightly broken way. It must absolutely grate on Aschenbach's ears to hear that. And yet his love for this boy is so consuming that it was what you said about sort of these annoying Venetians sort of interrupting the stream of consciousness of the music in his mind, and he gets so irritated by other people, and yet he does not mind it when Tasha is doing that.
It's the halo effect. It's like, I love you, and whatever you do, I love, you know, and it doesn't matter what you do.
Absolutely.
I mean, one other film I would note in terms of this use of music, or a repeated use of music, would be Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love, is that sort of like it just keeps starting the record over and over again, so that you're kind of, you know, always the same, always different sort of feeling to it, and it deepens your relationship to the music.
And an obsessional quality as well, which is so important, that sort of playing that same sequence over and over again, just that's, you know, by the end of the film, if you've never heard that movement before, you will know it intimately. And that's it's the same with like the theme in Le Mépris by Godard, Camille's theme by Delarue. It just comes again and again and again. And it is, as you said about In the Mood for Love with the Yumeji theme, is that it's a signifier of romantic, lustful obsession with someone else. And I suppose you keep playing that record too many times, it starts to become irritating, or it changes meaning. And I suppose that's sort of a translation of something that is ineffable, that cannot be described or expressed, which is what Visconti brings out of the book and casts in a very cinematic way, which is distinct from the literary style of Thomas Mann.
Yeah. I'm just thinking how, you know, when you're, I mean, it's almost a naff way of putting it, but it's that sort of when you're in love and you play the song over and over again, mm-hmm. which reminds you of that. It's a cinematic equivalent. Oh, just as a digression, what was your take on Maestro? I feel it's been a film a little bit underserved by the critical community.
Yeah, I agree. It was very frustrating because every review seemed to begin with the line, "I know nothing about Mahler." I mean, nothing about Bernstein, rather. And I found that happening.
Maybe open Wikipedia.
Well, exactly. Or to just use that as an excuse to dismiss it. I mean, it is a film. It's not really... I suppose it is about Bernstein, but it really is about that, what I said about that sort of feeling that one can never be as good at doing the thing that you love that someone else is able to do. It's about a feeling of getting to a point in life where one realizes that they haven't achieved what they wanted, and trying to express that to people who do not have a similar sort of obsession with ascending to a level of greatness. I think that what frustrated me about Maestro, if anything, is that it didn't perhaps explore to a greater extent how important teaching became for Bernstein, and really that Bernstein's legacy and most important impact is as a teacher. And you see that in Tal when she goes back at the end and is watching the videotapes of his young person's concerts, and how Bernstein's love of music was so infectious. And I used to watch those Bernstein clips on YouTube when I was growing up, and that was absolutely how I learned so many things about music. And more importantly, that it taught me that I didn't need to keep trying to learn scales and arpeggios and understanding music theory, because I just really struggle with that. And that what really matters is that one does sort of open one's mind to music. Since from a very early age, I've been very moved by music. I remember my grandmother took me to hear Elgar's cello concerto, and she was crying, and I could see her crying, and it sort of gave me license to cry. And I've always just wept, and I've never tried to understand it. I do to some extent try to understand it. There's a moment in the film when the musician friend is saying, you know, here's a chord, you know, you can make up any infinite number, it's all mathematics. Well, I'm not terribly interested in the mathematics of music. I'm much more interested in that sort of aesthetic pleasure or sadness or pathos again, that comes from that. And I think that's what Maestro is about. It's about how we approach music is one of sensibility. And really, this is all very Germanic. I think that's an important thing for us to talk about, is the fact that this... it's why I was slightly hesitant of even choosing it to talk about on an Italian cinema podcast, because this film and the book is so German. Yeah, because it is very German, and it is rooted in German philosophy, in Romanticism and aesthetic philosophy in particular, of Goethe and Schiller, sort of around, so we have sort of Kant writing Critique of Judgment, and then moving to, and the idea of a sublime, moving towards that sort of Sturm und Drang within ourselves of the struggle of art. And Goethe wrote, it's called Marienbad Elegy, which is about, he was 73 and he fell in love with a 17-year-old baroness, and he asked her to marry him and she said no, and he writes this poem that is one of Goethe's most personal pieces of writing. And you know, I don't think in sort of Werther style, I don't think he shoots himself with a pistol. But it's about that wrestle within the self of a forbidden love. I mean, that's quite an extreme example, I suppose, but it resonated with Marne specifically. And that kind of sensibility is one that I absolutely love and became quite obsessed with as a teenager, was these works of philosophy, that don't really give any examples of art. They just talk about it in a very abstract way. And I suppose there's an element of that in English Romanticism as well, particularly Shelley and Keats and their understanding of the sublime, which comes through within the novella and within the film. But it's very German. It's not something that is coming out of Italian philosophy or Italian understanding, I suppose. It's coming through Nietzsche and Wagner, of course, as well. Wagner spent a lot of time in Venice.
I was just about to say that. It always seems to connect to Italy as a location, right? You know, Nietzsche with Turin, and you know, Bellatar obviously makes a film mm-hmm. with Turin Horse, but because of the episode of Nietzsche's descent into madness, his last days. Shelley and Byron, you know, the poem Julian and Madelo is set on the Lido. They're you know, riding horses along the beach prior to the building of the Hotel de Bains.
And of course, where do Keats go to die?
Exactly. Yeah, in Rome. Absolutely. And you know, there's barely a city in Italy which doesn't have a blue plaque somewhere with, you know, mm-hmm. Goethe sat over there, or you know, Robert Browning sat here, or what have you. So in that sense, the sort of the landscape and the colours of Italy have, because I think that's one of the extraordinary moments in the film, is when you do cut to I keep mispronouncing his name, so I feel a little bit embarrassed now.
I would not worry.
Aschenbach.
I'm saying Aschenbach. It's probably Askenbach or okay, Askenbach. I don't know.
that would be terrible to No, there's a bit where we go from Venice to the mountains, and suddenly it punches you in the face how green, right, that green that has been missing. And similarly, when his friend comes on, who is played by like an English actor, I think he's mm-hmm. Mark Burns, he's called, and he seems to have parachuted in from a different film. He's just very shouty, and as you know, I mean, they're having a bit of a shouty argument anyway, but there's a sort of intensity to the acting which feels jolting somehow. And I don't know if it's necessarily him particularly, or just the fact that for a lot of the film, you're not getting that many interactions. You're getting things sort of going along. I think when you return from the various flashbacks back to Venice, it is, and this connects with what we're talking about in terms of Goethe going crazy with a love affair for a 17-year-old. And isn't it that also that, you know, you're in the portico in front of the House of Death, and you're suddenly thinking to yourself, why can't I do anything I want? You know, why can't I, you know, you suddenly looking at the teenage boys wrestling on the beach and thinking, how am I not that guy? You know, how is it impossible that I can have that relationship? Because isn't that his fantasy? Isn't his fantasy not me having a relationship with him? Isn't it, I want to be his teenage friend having a relationship with him?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's the fear of age and death. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the cholera is such an extraordinary metaphor, and the way that is encroaching on this place, which is, anyone who has been to Venice knows what an absolute sort of oasis it is. It's so beautiful. But then also there's the threat of that disappearing entirely as well, that one always gets in Venice. I mean, as you say, I suppose watching it with COVID in mind is impossible not to do. It is something that we have now all experienced within our lifetime and will probably experience again. And it can be overwhelming that you have this extraordinary beauty contrasted with a sort of fog of evil that surrounds everything. And the idea that this thing, which is, I mean, if I think of Lolita, it's so specific to Humbert in the way that he talks about 12-year-old nymphets, and that as soon as they grow out of that age, as soon as they turn 13, they are lost. That is a ruin. That is a sort of sullied specimen, I suppose. And I think that sort of the idea of a loss or the temporality of this beauty is something that is really horrifying to Aschenbach, that these things will not last. Even though, of course, the appeal of Italy, I suppose, as we were talking about, to these foreigners, to these outside people, is that things have lasted, is that you can go and see architecture and sculpture and painting and that have lasted, which one does not have such a sense of in other countries. So I suppose that's something that's quite, there's a conflict there, and the appeal of it is to return to a previous golden age that seems to have died everywhere else, but seems to still maintain a sense of itself in Italy and Rome and in Venice in particular. And that is the inspiration for creation and creativity. Wagner, who we mentioned, of course, wrote Tristan and Isolde there in Parsifal, and also died in Venice. So there's these strange overlaps between these different people and what they seem to have as an idea of the place to create. I mean, is Aschenbach there to write? He goes to the beach and he has a desk, but he's not writing. He's eating strawberries, and you know, when he is taken by illness, he goes and has that ridiculous makeup put on, which I think is such
moving.
It's very moving, and it creates this sort of death mask image to him. He's almost dead while he's still alive. But there's such sensuality to that sequence, the way the lipstick is applied to him, the extreme close-ups of his skin. It's the most erotic sequence in the film, I would say. And then he goes and sees him, but he doesn't notice him. And he dies yearning and reaching out for this boy as the makeup runs on the side of his face without having achieved anything.
So is he Rudy Giuliani's?
Right, exactly.
I mean, the thing I find... There's almost like a subject. Sorry.
Yeah, it's great. I had forgotten that comparison.
there's something so great about that, because I always think there's a moment when you're, because illness is kind of subjective. It's kind of when the subject is trapped in itself, and you can have a temperature and that gives you some sort of communication with the outside world that you're not feeling well. But there's always a bit of me that is sort of like, almost, come on, you're just feeling sorry for yourself. Get up, have a shower, get dressed, get out. You'll feel better if you start moving. And you sort of auto, you know, diagnose yourself, and you think, if I just pretend I'm not ill, if I hadn't got into bed, I'd be okay now. And so it feels like an almost heroic effort to you know, regroup. Let's get the former glories together. And yes, I will be an object worthy of my love. And then it's all for, not only is it all for nothing, but it kind of robs him of his dignity almost at the end. Right. Of like, he's not an old man dying in a chair. He's the made up nonce who's dying in the chair, to go back to that sort of like way of looking at it. From outside, you know, and being carried off. By the way, I love the details of the fruit sellers, which goes around, which is also, it's something that still happens to this day, that if you go to the beach, you have people coming around selling usually coconuts. Coco, coco. And they're, you know, going up and down. It's like the sound of the beach is people selling fruit and stuff. So that's a brilliant touch.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose that's where the sort of pathetic nature is, and I mean that in sort of taking pity on this man, is that I suppose that anyone who has ever tried to be creative in any sense is that kind of frustration of inertia and procrastination that comes from that. What's so fascinating about someone like Humbert or Aschenbach is that they think of themselves as intellectuals, and they think of themselves as, you know, sort of creating these great works. And again, I suppose Bernstein in Maestro or Lydia Tár in Tár is that these are people who think that they are so committed to the art and that there is nothing else. And yet that is prevented or corrupted by lust and desire. And that is what prevents them from getting the work done. And yeah, it does arouse in one a feeling of pity. I wouldn't say necessarily sympathy, but certainly say that is, you feel sorry for these people, but in a slightly distasteful way, I would say. But it does sort of put onto one some sort of internal reflection of that as well, I suppose. And of Visconti, I mean, there's a reason why this is appealing to him, in the same way that Mann was inspired by Goethe and by Mahler and so forth, is that there is a resonance with this. Why death in Venice? Well, Visconti is himself sort of deeply attracted to this most beautiful boy in the world, as he called him, and he and the crew, who were mostly gay men, took this 16-year-old boy to a gay club. And Bjørn Andersen has talked about that, and there's a documentary about it in more recent years, about that sort of feeling of being exploited, and his sort of relationship, how much he hates this film, because he looks back on it as someone who was being abused effectively, as a part of this, of the production of this film. That almost in a quite a macabre way, the creation of this film was almost a guise for allowing Visconti to have his own sort of death in Venice type situation, which, when one realizes that and when one views it in that way, it does kind of, that gaze and those zooms and the way that Andersen is filmed is really quite horrifying in many ways. I think there's a really sickening aspect to this film, which, you know, with the sort of the way that cholera is encroaching on Venice is an apposite sensation to have. And the way that we reflect on that is very important.
I interviewed Andersen for that documentary that he did, and he's definitely a character who has had a story and had a story that is, I mean, there were lots of years after the film that he went to Japan. This film was hugely influential in the anime way of imagining young men in sailor suits,
right?
You know, yeah, it runs all the way through, and partly that the success of the film in Japan meant that he had a pop career in Japan, and was right. So there was a kind of thing that he I absolutely, you know, fully take on what he says about his feeling uncomfortable and feeling and being put in situations he shouldn't have been put in as effectively a child. Yeah, and it is interesting, that thing that you're saying about the gaze of the camera, how to some degree it's difficult to, it's like watching a film about animal cruelty, you know, the right. Animals have been injured, and there's no way you can sort of not watch it without in some ways having to address that. At the same time it's happened, and it's there, and it's part and parcel of it, and I find that problem is actually still so current. I mean, the fact that we've just recently had a documentary come out about the founder of Nickelodeon, or one of the main directors of the Nickelodeon Children's Film Channel, TV channel, which with some appalling allegations of bad behavior, it just shows that this is, you know, men looking at children and professional adults using children in creating entertainment, creating. I wouldn't necessarily put iCarly on the level of art as such, but, you know, these are human beings and they've been put through the sausage mm-hmm. machine, and it's been done in the name of spectacle, and it's I think it's kind of still with us.
Oh, absolutely it is. But I suppose what we've talked about sort of several times is the way that one that engages with that, and the approach that one, it's this notion that, you know, oh, then we just sort of dismiss it and don't engage with it, is, or even, you know, engage with it as art is to me completely absurd.
The only person who I get slightly sort of jaded with in the sort of like, is I watched Leni Riefenstahl's, Triumph of the Will, and I just was like, oh, they're just bloody Nazis. I've had enough Nazis, you know. And you can look at it aesthetically and, you know, all the rest of it, but after a while.
Yeah, I mean, obviously these things are so nuanced and individual, but I don't know. I mean, something like Triumph of the Will and Riefenstahl is to observe something which is, that's the historian in me engaging with that.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I do think that there is a cinematographic artistry to that film, more so to Riefenstahl's 1936 Olympia films. But yes, I suppose it's sort of viewing it as that kind of historical. And it comes back again to what we were talking about Bogart as well, that it's these films are so interesting to me to engage with as looking at a different way of engaging with the world and how someone saw the world. To watch this film, to watch Death in Venice, is to see Visconti's perspective in the same way that to read Death in Venice is to see Thomas Mann's perspective. And one does not need to make a moral judgment of that person in order to understand what is going on and to see that there is an art to that form of self-reflection, I think. How one responds to that in one's own mind and body is individual, but that does not mean that it should not be engaged with, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
As with the Riefenstahl example, I'm in absolutely no way saying other people shouldn't watch it. I'm just saying that would be one of the bits that I would be watching, or as I go through with it, it's like, am I getting anything out of this? You know, is it really? Yeah, I'll watch it once and see what it's like, but it's not. It's kind of not. I'm fed up. There's too many Nazis. But I'm not going to write. You know, we should cancel Leni Riefenstahl. Right. I've just found this interview in Playboy where she says things.
Yeah, but it does reframe it, and I think that's what's interesting. I mean, what we know about Riefenstahl completely affects the way that we watch her films, in the same way that watching how does Death in Venice change when one knows, as we do now, well, at least as Anderson has described it, that Visconti himself was making this film with a similar lens to the one that Thomas Mann was making. Does that change our relationship to the film? I think it does, because the way this film is shot is so unique, with those incredible sort of 360-degree pans through the spaces and those zooms, which are, I mean, I think I saw someone on Letterboxd in their review had described this film as like a sort of TikTok thirst cam kind of thing, but, you know, set to Mara. And I thought, that's so interesting, because I think that that is what it is, but a director could create that effect and say, you're seeing it from Aschenbach's perspective, and negate the fact that it's actually their perspective as a director. But in this case, it's so interesting to think that actually there was the compulsion was there within Visconti, and whether or not that's true. That ambiguity is very fascinating to me.
And it's also interesting that where this comes in his career as well, in the sense that, you know, he's made so many diverse films, you know, from Ossessione right at the beginning, La Terra Trema, Rocco e Suoi Fratelli, all the way through to The Leopard, and then this. It just feels it has that extra weight of something personal. And it's a little bit like you were saying about de Bogart after 1967. There's sort of a sense that in his previous films, you might watch how he films Alain Delon in Rocky e Suoi Fratelli and say, oh, hello, now I can retrospectively understand why he loves Alain Delon as a thing. I mean, is it also... Let me frame this as a question. Is it also important to look at a queer director and not, you know, we don't look at heterosexual directors and always think of their heterosexuality as they're filming. So is there an element where we should be careful not to, you know, I mean, a heterosexual director would film Alain Delon beautifully because, for God's sake, you know, it's Alain Delon. You've got a camera. You're in the business of filming things beautifully. Is there a danger of that as well, of sort of ascribing sex and lust and those things to the artist, in a sort of biographical way, really?
Right. Interesting. So, I mean, that's obviously coming out of sort of Mulvey's characterization of Hitchcock and the way that he's shooting women, and whether or not one could apply a similar judgment to Visconti's, you know, filming here or any other gay male director. I mean, I think that this conversation became most interesting when Portrait of a Lady on Fire was released, and there was that sort of attempt to coin the phrase female gaze and what that might mean, where a lesbian director is, and the way that they shoot women's bodies is different or perhaps even permissible, whereas a man looking at a woman in that way is not. There was a dreadful documentary by Nina Menkers called Brainwashed, which was sort of accusing, not necessarily Sciamma, but certainly people like Julia Ducanals, Sofia Coppola, and other women directors as apparently sort of, you know, being complicit to the male gaze.
It's like the false class consciousness of Marx.
Well, precisely. So she sort of points at the opening shot of Lost in Translation, for example, and says, you know, that Sofia Coppola is complicit in the way that men have viewed and treated women in cinema, which to me is absurd. And also to condemn other women for doing that is, anyway, doesn't matter. You can cut that bit out. But I don't want to get too cancelled for what I'm saying. But I think that what I'm trying to say is that I do think that I understand the need to the desire to critique how something is being shot, and I absolutely believe that is the case. And there are examples that I can think of how something is shot that has made me deeply uncomfortable, and that I have had a sort of moral objection to in the way that something is shown. I think, for example, of Ali Abassi's Holy Spider, which I saw last year, and the way that he frames sexual assault in that film was repugnant for me watching it, and I felt that there was a certain fetishization of the depictions of that, and I have a very sort of a real sensitivity to the way that directors try to frame things, and I'm very interested in it, engaging with it. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the discomfort that one feels from watching the way that Visconti is framing Taccio is deriving from a more removed positionality. It's not one that is necessarily, it doesn't feel as assaultive or aggressive as perhaps other examples would do. And as you say, is it worth even trying to characterize these things? Well, I think it is when a director is doing it self-consciously, or they're aware of it, or they're critical of it. I mean, Peeping Tom is so fascinating to me because Michael Powell is so critical of himself making that film. It's the same with Vertigo and Hitchcock. He's very self-aware of his own behaviors and desires and sexual preferences and the way that he is framing women. It's a very sort of self-reflective thing. And Death in Venice is absolutely that. It is a novel. It is a novella about how he's almost sort of self-loathing in many ways. It's about how that internalized homophobia or a fear of a completely forbidden desire, which is, you know, the desire for a child, and the sort of grappling with that, and how that is resisted, which is an extraordinary thing to read. It's very naked and very open. Obviously, it's veiled within fiction, but as you know, it's very thinly veiled, I think, in the case of that novella, and it's so too would I say that it is in the case of the making of this film.
And I mean, it's kind of visceral because you're watching somebody watching, and it's, you know, it can't help but be self-reflective. You can't help but say, am I watching this boy in the same way this man is watching this boy? Am I watching this man with the same level of empathy that I would afford everyone, or I would, you know, want to? And the, you know, I mean, again, one of the most crushing scenes in this film is just when he dies, and the spoiler, and the two beach attendants just sort of lift him up, and he's suddenly this limp heavy body, and it's just so, it's like, okay, all that music is just this now. Or you know, that's gone, and all we've got left is the music, I guess.
Yeah, the credits start rolling. And they end before the music has resolved. It just sort of fades out in the way that songs used to. So I suppose it's not satisfying. There's no satisfaction from that ending. We don't get the catharsis. It's the fourth movement. There's another movement to go in Marlon's Fifth. We're stuck on that fourth movement over and over again. But we do get a bit of the Third Symphony as well. But for the most part, it's just unresolved. It's just, it's like, listening to a piece of music and not listening to the final note. It's just horrible. It leaves you in that sort of lurch position where you don't get that finale that is so that is where the pleasure comes from, I suppose. And we're not permitted to experience that. It's the use of music is very interesting to me, is that Benjamin Britten writes his final opera, which is based on Death in Venice, at around the same time, and he was told you must not watch the film when it comes out in 71. Death in Venice premieres in 73 because it will inform the way you do it. And I actually saw the opera before I saw the film, and the way that it's cast is that it's mostly Aschenbach singing in a gondola on a stage, and then there are these incredible ballet sequences with Taccio. Taccio is a non-singing role. So it's this sort of dance opera hybrid that I just absolutely love. And it really creates that sort of separation of space that you get in the film as well, of the beach and the hotel and how distinct those spaces are. There's a sort of Elysian aspect to that beach, particularly when he's dying, and you can sort of, you know, it sort of blurs and it all becomes so hazy in the sunset.
And you've got the sea, there is death, you know, the sea is right in front of you, and it's amazing. And today the Hotel de Banz is I think they're for years it was closed, and I would walk by it, and it's a sort of destitute, fenced off sort of area. Still, you know, the structure still has structural integrity. And now I think they're opening it up and they're doing like art installations in there and things like that. Well, so it's coming back to life a little bit, which is a great thing to see.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there's so much that can be done with that. And as I say, it has such an extraordinary cultural legacy of these people, as Venice does, of these people coming to Venice to create. Yeah, I don't know. The Britain is interesting to me, because that sort of distinct, that decision to have the different characters, that you have this sort of dance. It's interesting because of the fact that the Taccio is non-speaking, as he is in the book and as he is in the film, that if you gave him a voice, it would be wrong, because he's not real. And I think that's really important, is that he's not, I don't know, what am I trying to say?
If you overheard too much of his conversation with his friend, for instance, you would just think, you know, okay, he's just an annoying teenager, or he's a nice teenager, and you start treating him as a human being, and that's not what... And likewise, there is an element in his unrealness that, like, his teenage friend is much more like a teenager. He's much more rambunctious and rolling around in the sand and whatnot. And even from his friends, he's treated with a little bit more, he's a little bit more untouchable and ethereal. And that could be seen with a certain eye as, he's kind of a little bit flirty, because he's there and he knows he's being, there's a sort of knowingness to him being watched. But that could also be a projection.
Oh, yeah. I think it's all projection. I mean, this boy probably doesn't look like the boy that we are seeing. It's just, that's his fantasy. It's all in his head. And I think that's really important to remember, especially, you know, the sort of critical aspect of it, is that this is all internal. This is very much Aschenbach's problem. It is not anyone else, that it's entirely his way of thinking, and he's so obsessed with it. And as I said, I mean, it's not in the film, but there's this dream, and it's in the Britain Opera. He has this incredible sequence where the gods start singing to Aschenbach, and that's all fantasy. He's so trapped in his own mind and his sense of almost divine importance, which is an extraordinary thing to read and to think about.
But it's an artist, isn't it? I mean, you can only talk to the gods, because who else understands your words as a creator?
Exactly. He has this sort of extraordinary narcissism and egoism that is. I wonder if the film captures that as effectively other iterations of Death in Venice have done. Perhaps not. I don't think that we quite get a sense of just how high this man's opinion is of himself in the film. But he's a slightly different character, so it doesn't matter. But it's not. I don't think we quite get the sense that this is a man who believes he's in communion with the Pantheon.
He feels a lot more uncertain than that, and a lot more haunted by his past failures, perhaps. And it's always nice to see Marissa Berenson, who plays his wife. Listen, Lillian, it was such an interesting conversation to get into so deeply into this film, which is a film, as I say, I've only watched twice, and I feel that my appreciation of it has really risen via this discussion and via certainly that second watching as well. Would you have any other Italian films you'd like to recommend for our listeners? Something that you feel particularly keen about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned that I couldn't find a copy in the end, unfortunately, not in time. But another film that I was interested in talking about is a film called Un'ora sola ti vorrei, or For One More Hour With You, by Elena Marazzi, who's a very interesting filmmaker. She also made a feature with Charlotte Rampling. But this film in particular, I mean, it has sort of a similar idea to how Death in Venice as a film is constructed, is that it's a sort of collage essay film taken off footage of her mother, who she has very little memory of. She committed suicide when she was seven. When Elena Marazzi was seven, her mother died by suicide, and she's attempting to create a sense of her mother so that she could sort of know her through this sort of home footage that she has. And it's one of the most extraordinary films I've ever seen. I saw it because I had access to it when I was at university, and I haven't been able to watch it since. So I highly recommend, if there is any ability to see that film.
Do you recommend it, but if anybody out there finds a copy, could you please contact us?
Let me know. I mean, I know that there's copies that are in Italian, but it's finding ones that have subtitles is the tricky part. But it's, there's a wonderful essay by Laura Mulvey in her book After Images about it, and there's a wonderful piece by Emma Wilson, who taught me university, and was how I saw it, that I recommend reading as well. And then Alice Rohrbacher's La Chimera, which I have seen recently and was completely blown away by. I mean, it's a film of a kind of filmmaking that I don't think really exists anymore. And I just, that sort of very erudite filmmaking that refuses to explain what it's doing is something that I really love and appreciate, and it's very much grounded in that sort of exploration of the past, and the past sort of rising up into the present, that I really love in Rohrbacher's filmmaking. So those are two, and then I saw a short documentary recently about the final scene of Voyage to Italy, which is one of my favorite Italian films by Rossellini, about the final scene and who the people are in that last scene of that film. And I thought that was really, really, really beautiful. And I love that film. I saw it again at the BFI recently, and it's so gorgeous. And again, that sort of idea of the past and archaeology is so important to that film as well. So, yeah. There's three recommendations. One that's very easy to find, one that's coming out, and one that takes a bit of digging.
Great. I love Rohrwacher's work. Is she's so interested in these sort of subcultures and societies outside of society that sort of go through. She has a sort of medieval eye. Reminds me a little bit of Pasolini,
right,
on sort of Italian society. So yeah, it'd be great to do an episode on her one of these days. Brilliant. Well, listen, thank you so much, Lydian. I really enjoyed the conversation, and yeah, hopefully you'll come on again to talk some more.
Thank you so much.
Arrivederci ragazzi, ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.